Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to something we're calling Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and Randy Olson joins me.
Hello.
So thank you all for listening to this initial show of this new initiative called Virtues of Peace, which is a branch, if you will, of Ethics Talk, which is a show that we were doing for about 3 years. We started that in 2009. There's a website for that show, ethicstalk.org, and this is a new initiative that we're launching on this historic day of May 18th, which is the original Peace Day. And I say the original because there is another Peace Day that's celebrated in September, which is the UN International Day of Peace. But rest assured that there is very important pre-UN international law history, and this original Peace Day it opens the door to that and enters the forest to that. So we will be talking about that today, and if you have an anecdote or some other interesting tidbit to share, you of course can call in. It's 516-387-1449. So let me just give a brief background about Peace Day, May 18th. May 18th, 1899, was the day on which the 1899 Hague Peace Conference opened. I think the day that the Hague Peace Conference closed was July 29th, 1899. So it went for about 3 months, two to three months. And there are a number of outcomes of that conference, but it really was brought about because of the organized peace movement, and we like to refer to it as they did, which is the peace through law movement. As it says on the show description, one of the outcomes of this conference was the establishment of a brand new court called the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and this court was one of the goals of the peace movement to create a new court, a process that allowed states to solve their disputes nonviolently. So there's a lot of history around this moment, and what's so fascinating is that this court still exists. When we think about international law, international peace and justice, we typically, if you go back before World War II, people typically think of the League of Nations and they think, oh, that failed. But League of Nations was an outcome of World War I. And again, this is before World War I, 1899. So it is a treasure trove of inspiring stories, ideas, etc. And the objective of this podcast, both specifically and in general, is to unearth some of these stories. I also would be remiss if I didn't note that today, May 18th, is also a very important day in South Korea because it's the day of the Gwangju Democratic Uprising, May 18th, 1980. This is a topic for another show, but if you're interested in that, there is a wonderful film called A Taxi Driver, not to be confused with Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro, but A Taxi Driver. If you go to our show resources page, there should be a link to the trailer. If you've seen the excellent film Parasite, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture this year, the main actor in that movie, the father, whose name I think is Song Kang-ho, appears as a main character in Taxi Driver. It's a really moving film, and so if you want to start to learn about the development of democracy in Korea, this is an excellent film, and today is an historic day in Korea. There's a lot of commemorative activities going on, but it's not happy history. It's not positive history. So this is like the yang to the yin of positive history, as we call it. So, Randy, let's begin with just a definition of peace, because what we're going to try to do in this show is have the listeners understand this historic framework, and not only that framework, but the concrete methods that individuals can undertake to engage in what's called peace work. And so to get us there, can you share a definition of peace?
Yeah, absolutely. I think starting with a definition seems like the appropriate place to launch into a conversation. The title that we came up with was Organizing for Peace, Organizing for Memory, a celebration of Peace Day. And I love the concept of beginning with a definition in order to be organized about what it is we're trying to talk about. So there's a definition of peace that comes from Jane Addams, which I'll preface by saying, it's not only the absence of war. You know, when we think about peace nowadays, there's this, like, the vernacular includes this idea of anti-war. Like, for whatever reason, like, that's lodged into the consciousness of the English language and of people that, at least the people I've had the privilege of encountering. But Jane Addams had a sort of better definition. And so in her newer Ideals of Peace, Jane Addams defines peace by saying, peace would no longer be an absence of war, but the unfoldment of worldwide processes making for the nurture of human life. Now, I love this because what it does is it provides the boundaries around which we can clearly identify whether or not something is not peace, but it leaves the end kind of open infinitely for what might actually be peace. And that makes it the most accurate thing that I can imagine. Now, why would the definition need to have an infinite possible scope, right? That's the first thing I want to dive down into. And so, like, what does it mean to nurture the development, the unfoldment of something? Like, is there a right way to nurture a child? Well, yes and no, right? We can create state platitudes about, yes, a child needs love in order to grow. But what the right way to do that is inevitably has like a necessary relationship between context and that individual. And so by comparison, in order to really understand what the nurture of human, in order to nurture humanity as a whole, there's these contextual elements that we have to take into consideration that's built into this definition that really it forces us to take the idea of peace and realize it as an ideal rather than as a location or like as a state of existence or as a thing, right? It's like peace is something that you need to orient yourself towards and start to move towards. And then you can, measure whether or not the policies or the strategies that are being implemented are in line with that by, lining your awareness up and looking carefully, right? There's a method for measuring it. But, first and foremost, this idea that peace is an ideal that we strive towards is built into this definition, and I love that. And so, the thing that I really want to stress about it is, humanity has to grow and develop. Everybody seems to have an agreement about that, and the definition of peace and how we do it, how we acquire it, how we aim towards it, how we bring it into being, inevitably has to grow alongside humanity. And so as things get more complex in the world, the requirements for peace also get more complex. And that's why, you know, we have to remember what peace was about 100 years ago or more, and what it, you know, and then we have to try to prepare the world in such a way as to, you know, create the conditions for peace to be possible 100 years from now.
Yeah, and your point before about how, like, these days, this term anti-war really dominates. And I think my best guess is that that arises out of the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I found that a lot of peace activists in the United States, you know, became peace activists because of the Vietnam War. That's what I've found in my travels here. And that's why I think this history is so important, because it is an extremely important part of American history that is erased from the public conscious. And it's not just American history, it's international history. But the United States plays a very specific role in this history, and I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Bertha von Suttner, who was the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1905. You mentioned Jane Addams, and she was the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Her definition of peace is what you're citing. But Bertha, how I learned about Peace Day is not from any formal education whatsoever. It's such a long story, but I was reading a speech that Bertha von Suttner gave in 1912, okay, again, before World War One begins in Europe and the United States enters World War One in 1917, but in 1912, she's Bertha von Suttner, who by then was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, she was famous for this, is the keynote speaker for the National Education Association. And she gives a speech that says, what you're doing in the United States is so progressive, you'll never see this happening in Europe. This is the new world. Like, this is where things are going to happen. And she says, for example, you celebrate Peace Day. And I read that sentence, and I said, what is she talking about? And that planted the seed, and that led me to, yeah, learning about Peace Day, which was this huge thing. And there is a New York Times article from 1912 that's connected to our show resources page. this is an important part of American history, is my point. And so this is really, really important. This, and your point is, like, look, this earlier definition that this is something that we're striving for. When you think of peace simply as anti-war, there's not, you know, a sort of goal that's obvious towards which you're striving. And so that's really important. It's nurture of human life. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, just to provide, you know, for me, it really helps to have visuals. And so, you know, if we imagine the shape of a cone, right, or like a megaphone, right, but like a really, really long one, right, this definition, which, you know, it puts this particular kind of cone-shaped thing around the idea, such that, you know, we can clearly point to when things are not nurturing the unfoldment of, you know, human potential, and, you know, it's clearly not. But then what's on the inside of that, it has so much space, right? So it, like, what can qualify as nurturing has an enormous number of things that could be included. But there is a boundary. And so, you know, it's one of these flexible definitions. It's very, very powerful. And it, as far as I can tell, pretty far into what peace might be and how it might have emerged. And so, so I guess I'm a little curious. It sounds like there's quite a story here. What's the scoop on Peace Day in the United States? Like, you know, I'm a little foggy on some of that history.
Well, I mean, that, are we, well, okay. I would like to come back to this definition. Let's just mark, you know, we're still fleshing out this definition of what peace is. Let me answer your question as well as try to add on to this definition and flesh out what we mean by nurture by saying, look, Peace Day in the United States was about education. And this piece of education as being an essential plank of the peace movement, I mean, it was undeniable. And by the way, it is an essential plank of, I would guess, the new form of the peace through law movement, which is the international human rights law movement. Because if you read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the preamble, I mean, education is definitely flagged as essential to implementation of this ideal. So Peace Day was about education. And that's why these commemorative days are celebrated. I mean, even in international criminal justice, so now we have like the International Criminal Court and we have International Criminal Justice Day, which is July 17th. Why do we have that day? So that people start to learn about the International Criminal Court. So it was the same thing back then. And you had this day to be a means to educate people about this new framework, this new international framework that was being built. I want to say also that it's so striking to me, and I've said this, you probably have heard me say this before, Randy, but page 1, volume 1, issue 1 of the American Journal of International Law, which I believe it's 1906 or 1907, the very first article, the very first page, the very first issue is titled The Need for a Popular Understanding of International Law. So it's like, there it is. And, you know, the author of that, if I recall, is Elihu Root. and so there it is. So Peace Day was about education, and education is a principal way by which we nurture human life. So there's a connection there. I can say much more about it, but I'll turn it back to you because I know that you're a fan of Elihu Root. So,
yeah. So the first fun fact, you know, Elihu Root, he ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1912, but he never really got to deliver his Nobel lecture because of, you know, the situation in Europe that is essentially remembered now as the Great War. Right, World War One, and the, you know, the things that were occurring in Europe leading up to it proved to make this speech never occur. But in his Nobel speech, which you can access on the Nobel site, like, he did submit he was ready to give the talk or to give the speech. It's titled "Towards Making Peace Permanent," and he does such a unbelievably good job of unpacking how simply saying that peace is a good idea and everybody should be on board for working towards peace isn't enough, you know, and he does such a wonderful job of, again, pointing to the fact that war is the product of the animal side of man, whereas peace is a product of the rational, higher side of man. And so just sort of waiting, these conditions that spark wars are tapping into latent energies that are just sort of, they're just there all the time, that are, you know, they're part of being a human being. They're, you know, the animal in humans gets stimulated, and the rational part has to react and to take care of those problems as they emerge. And so there's this defense that the side of peace has to always be in, and is almost like a reactionary place. And he points out, which, you know, there's also that same article that you referenced, but his thesis is the thing that we have to do in order for any semblance of peace to be a part of a world in the future, is to understand our obligations as international citizens, as cosmopolitans, because if individuals don't understand that they are part of a global community, the concept of treating your neighbor with love and kindness isn't going to extend far enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how much we talk about peace in, you know, in this sort of shallow way where we don't want people to have to suffer, we don't want people to have to, you know, go through bad things, like there's this grand idea above that that we all have to work towards, so that everybody can be working towards the same things. And, you know, it's this scaling up of personal responsibility, which forms the bedrock for a real peace. It's like, it comes all the way down to the level of the individual. And he does, again, a beautiful job articulating that in his speech that was never delivered for winning the Nobel Prize in 1912. So, I strongly recommend anyone who's interested to check that out. It should be part of the resources.
Yep, it is. I just wanted to remind people, if you know you want to contribute to the conversation, feel free to call in or Skype in, 516-387-1449. This idea that you're scaling up the idea of duties is extremely important.
So one more thing, actually. So, because you mentioned the emphasis on education is like paramount, right? And when Peace Day was a thing, the education did not occur only at a certain, you know, at a certain age, right? It was happening for children. It was happening for teenagers. It was happening for adults. Everybody was being provided with a set of information. And there's a part of that that I'm really attracted to, namely that, you know, there's these seeds being planted in children about the, like, international obligations and recognizing all of the globe as effectively a neighbor. It's like there's something so beautiful about that. This planting of a seed early on, so that, you know, as children grow and develop and learn more about the world, it's already there that the people who are in another country, who have a totally different way of life, still have a relationship with you, and your choices and your lives have a direct impact on them. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that this is before globalization is anywhere near what it is today, right? Now we know that every time we go to the store, we're interacting with the entire planet, where, you know, this product is from this side of the world and this product is from this side of the world. And, you know, it was produced there, but that means part of it was grown over here. And, you know, there's this enormous web of global interaction that's part of every single moment of our lives now. And we almost can't ignore it in the modern world. And the people who we are talking about, the people who are responsible for instantiating Peace Day into the world, into the United States, they were completely aware that that's where the world is headed.
And I want to add that, and because this really, well, I think we're getting to this a little bit, but building on this definition of peace, and you're pointing out that, look, Peace Day was planting the seed in children, so that they understand that they're a member of a world community and that everyone's a neighbor. And I want to add, you know, you mentioned Jane Addams' definition of peace, and I also want to add that a phrase that was used at the time, so we're talking the late 1800s, early 1900s, before World War I, was social peace. And again, this is the idea that this is not necessarily just about building a court of law, but about infusing education with certain values. And the person who promoted this idea of social peace, her name is Cora Debrazza, and she's very important to Peace Day. And as you know, she focused on the individual, right? Like you begin with the individual. So there's a couple ways you can, like what that means. So one is we begin with the individual child by planting the seed that there is this global community and that everyone's a neighbor. But Cora Debrazza pointed out, and she's in the tradition of Plato, I would say, that, you know, before you're a good neighbor to another person, whether they're in your town or across the world, you have to be a good neighbor to yourself. You have to be, you know, friendly to yourself. And so developing that harmony within yourself, she said, is like the first step of peace work. So I just want to connect what you're saying, because we can talk about, you know, neighbors across the world, and we have certain obligations to them. And so she and others said we have obligations to ourselves as human beings, as part of this thing. We have these primary obligations to ourselves to get, you know, harmony created in the psyche, very similar to what Plato says in the Republic, that justice is harmony of the soul.
Yeah, just, you know, building on that, and I can't quote it off the at the top of my head, but I know that when the peace flag becomes officially instantiated into the International Council of Women, Susan B. Anthony like holds her hand to her heart and says something along the lines of "Peace starts with here," mm-hmm. like "Peace starts here," "Peace starts mm-hmm. with this person,"
mm-hmm.
and you know she's directly acknowledging that in order to really make any progress towards peace at a high, you know, at a global scale or at a national scale or even at a local scale, you have to have done some work inside of yourself. And so I know that that's something I really want to stress. And so I'll take this opportunity to transition into that now. And so the question, you know, just to organize it carefully is, you know, why is it important to remember stories of certain people or certain events in history? And what is it about those stories that we individually can do in order to grow, in order to make peace this, you know, living power in our lives? And I'd like to use an analogy. Because fundamentally, as individuals, we all know what it's like to heal from something terrible, right? I've never met a single person who hasn't had something bad happen in their lives. And the question is, you know, how do we deal with that? And it's not actually that much of a mystery anymore. The world of psychiatry has tremendous literature about healing and dealing with trauma and recovering from things. And the super paraphrased version is, you know, a person needs to have a framework around which the event that needs to be healed, like the wound, can be understood, acknowledged, and then there needs to be this mechanism in place within the individual such that they have like a motivation come the kind, like the specific kind of evil or the specific kind of pain that they had to endure, which left the scar, right? So, you know, taking that idea, we can scale it up. And we can say, okay, how is a country going to ever recover from an enormous trauma, an enormous traumatic event? And, you know, we could use a number of examples. The one that immediately comes to mind is South Africa for various reasons. And it's like, how did apartheid become something that was not like still this bleeding wound? Like, what did Nelson Mandela do and how did this all occur? It's a story that we could unpack and talk about for a very long time, but the short version is he made a set of things occur that forced everybody to look it right in the face and acknowledge what happened and couldn't really skirt around it. And this, like, this acknowledgement, this, okay, this occurred, now what? Attitude became instantiated in, like, the public consciousness. Now, it's amazing because that idea of acknowledgement forms this prerequisite for any kind of healing to take place, right? Because, you know, fundamentally, in order to heal from something like this, the main requirement, as far as I understand, is forgiveness, right? A person needs to be able to understand, you are a person, you did this, I was in a situation that forced, in some sense, these conditions to all collapse into reality in a horrific way. I understand the portion that I was involved in, if I've done sufficient internal work. And once I have the information about you and what you were doing and why you did what you did, all pieces are there to fully understand a situation. And once you have that information, forgiveness becomes possible. And I don't think it is possible until, like, a full sense of, like, real, complete forgiveness. It's not really possible until all the pieces are there and understanding is, like, firmly established. And so, you know, by comparison, right, we have at the level of the individual and at the level, like, the highest, the international global scale, we have the same mechanism taking place where something happens, you get enough information to make sense of it, and then you're in a position to heal that wound. And then the question is, okay, well, is it only a matter of just forgiving a situation? Like, well, no, there's so much more based on the context of what occurred and who it occurred to and how. And all of that can't be, like, we can't generalize to an infinite degree, but one of the beautiful things for me is that every spiritual tradition on the planet I'm aware of has this idea that, you know, when you take all of the pieces and you sit with them and you try to understand them and you try to forgive the perpetrators, there's this process that opens up inside of a human being that improves the situation, right? It's like this magical process that's packaged into being a human. Now, I don't want to say that forgiveness is something that's the only way to lead to peace, right? It's not the only ingredient, but it's certainly one of the main roads upon which the kinds of things that are conditions for war become manageable. Because, you know, if you hold a grudge, the first opportunity you can to retaliate, you're going to. And that, like, that malice, that contempt, that kind of thing must be addressed. And it's amazing because there are these stories of how people use these, like, completely secular methods to tap into spiritual traditions and the jewels that are at the heart of spiritual traditions and pull them into policy. So that was a long way of saying it's really important for us to remember the things that happen, to acknowledge them, and we can use that information in order to improve relationships in the future, both at the individual level and at the international level.
Yeah, and we got onto to that thread by my referencing Cora de Brazza's notion of social peace and where you begin that work. She says you begin with the germ. And we haven't really talked about her way of doing that, but the claim is out there that, look, there's like these different levels at which you do this work, and where do you begin? And so I think Cora de Brazza, like she formed a subcommittee called the International Arbitration and Social Peace. So it wasn't just international arbitration, it was and social peace. And that included this educational work, which is really like moral education, and that includes harmonizing, as she puts it, reason with passion. I do want to also say, like, you know, before you classified, when you were talking about Elihu Root and war, is getting at these like animal passions, and this is something akin to like having resentment towards another person and lashing out. I think that there's a disanalogy there, and I think that there's so much strategic planning and instrumental reasoning going on in war planning and tactics and decisions. I mean, it's highly intellectual and rational. I think that some people will say that's a misuse of reason, but it's not like it's all passion. It's there's like some thinking and calculation and deliberation involved. And I, Bertha von Suttner was one of the individuals who said that is a misuse of that faculty, that it's aimed at the wrong ends. but this point about, okay, we're talking about this establishing harmony at whatever level. And you made the point that forgiveness is an important part of this harmony, both individually and globally. And I just want to add to that, that I think that connected to forgiveness, like forgiveness is tied up with a whole suite of emotions like anger or resentment and blame, and that one has to work on the blame piece in working through forgiveness. So that's a conversation for another day. But any other? So we've established that peace is the unfolding of worldwide processes making for the nurture of human life. That nurture involves education, that this education involves a kind of like harmonizing with yourself and with other people, and that forgiveness is going to be part of that. Anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll use a quote from the speech that Elihu Root gave to kind of throw a big net around the like causes of war business. So he says, "To eradicate or modify or curb the tendencies which thus survive among civilized men is not a matter of intellectual conviction or training. It is a matter primarily of development of character and the shifting of standards of conduct, a long, slow process in which advance is to be measured not by days and years, but by generations and centuries in the life of nations." And I love that. It's this, you know, like it's this recognition that it's a long process, a long project. And yeah, there's the seeds for conflict and resentment and everything else that are still here with us in civilized countries and civilized times. Like, we're not done, and we need to think long term if we're going to really start to make a dent in dealing with the underlying causes of, you know, of things like war, both internally and externally.
Mm-hmm. And again, like going back to the wisdom of the Greeks, which Cora de Pratsa is definitely within the tradition of, you know, if the life force is aimed at the wrong thing, such as wealth, you know, that's just, that needs to be worked on. We could have all of the institutions in the world. We could have all the international courts in the world. But if humanity itself is not evolved in its character, right, and if its character is sort of aimed at these things that have been recognized a long time ago as not being the end all of human life, of meaning, then these institutions are not going to be worth very much.
So the idea that we have to start to put energy towards something different, I'd like to pick that thread up. I like that. It's like there needs to be this organization, this mobilization of moral energy towards a specific set of objectives that fall under the category of nurturing humanity, of nurturing human life, right? So it's like, okay, we need to organize, we need to like work towards this thing, because if we do nothing, the default is not peace, right? The default state is not Garden of Eden situation. Like the default state is a nightmare, because people have all these obvious incentives to accumulate things like wealth or power or whatever. And so it's like, well, in order to do peace work, there has to be this mobilization of energy in a specific new direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that idea has, like, people have seized upon that idea. Metanoia, a revolution of thought. Like, these are all phrases that have been used by various foot soldiers of the movement. And perhaps now is the time to begin, because we only have about 15 minutes left. And again, feel free to call in with an anecdote or question or comment, 516-387-1449. We have about 15 minutes left. But let's talk about some concrete tools that were developed to affect this change of consciousness or something new. Do you want to begin that conversation?
Sure. Cool. Yeah, absolutely. There's one in particular that has been a part of my life rather consistently since I discovered, or since you introduced it to me. And it's something called the Universal Peace Badge. There's a link in the resources page to a full description and image, picture of it and everything. But basically, there was an idea that in order to engage in the kind of internal transformation that has to take place in order for peace to be this serious part of our lives, having a physical token or an object helps to, in some sense, strengthen memory and reinforce the commitment to, you know, making peace part of a person's life and part of a person's, like, conscious actions. And so there's if you go to the resources page, you can see the actual pin. I carry one around with me to this day. I think it's been part of my traveling possession bag for very consistently for seven years now. And basically there's a short version and then a longer version. And the short version is, if you ever experience yourself not living up to the golden rule, you have to take the pin off. And it's this golden pin that's, you know, something you actually can wear. Or, you know, in my case, I just have it in my bag, right? And so when I recognize I'm not living up to that ideal, the ideal based on my own standards that I want to uphold, I take the part. And what that essentially is doing is it's forcing consciousness into the equation. You know, you're putting this physical motion, this physical activity into a rational and conscious struggle with yourself. Because we all do things that we know we shouldn't do, right? We say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to finish this assignment by this time, and I'm going to wake up tomorrow and exercise and, you know, 100 things in that category. And then we don't do it. And when we interact with other people that way, we're fundamentally being either dishonest or something close to that. And having something that's physical, that's tactile, that you can carry around with you, you can bring with you, really does have this tremendous effect. Because at some point, you know, if you're wearing the pin, for example, you're going to glance down and notice it. If you're, you know, if you don't always, because it's like it's attached to your body, and so therefore there's a physical sensation that's constantly reminding you to be conscious about what you're doing and how you're interacting with other people. So, like, that's the surface, the easy way to you know, communicate that information is by pointing to the golden rule. But then, you know, the pin itself, it was built to, you know, have that same model of forcing consciousness about certain kind of conduct. But then instead of just the golden rule, it's like it's elaborated, right? So there's the seven rules of harmony that are packaged into the universal peace bags. But, you know, they're all these direct, clear, like, it's unequivocal that, like, okay, if you're going to do, if you follow these instructions, you're going to be moving towards the direction of peace. And there's seven of them. I'm going to emphasize three of them because they personally speak to me. And if any of these speak to you or anyone who's listening, the resources page has this information. So the first rule, right, the very first rule on this list is make the sacred spirit of peace a living power in your life and contribute all possible time, thought, and money to its diffusion. And it's this wide catch-all idea, and I think that that's appropriate given it's the, you know, first of seven. And it's like, you know, you got to commit. You got to be all in. Right? There are some games you got to be all in if you want to play. And working towards the highest ideal possible, which is peace, implies this all-in kind of thing. And so, you know, here it is, the very first idea, you gotta be all-in. So then the fifth rule, right, and if you want the rest, just go to the resources page. It's worth it, I promise. The fifth one is treat all birds and beasts and all in all existences of the animal and vegetable world with justice and gentleness. Do not destroy save for self-preservation and for the preservation of the weak. Instead, make it your object to plant, to nourish, and to propagate all that will lead to the moral and physical amelioration of the family, the home, and the nation. And the part I want to zoom in on that is this seed metaphor again, where, you know, it's your personal responsibility to plant the seeds for the actions in the world that are going to improve conditions for families, homes, and the people who are close to you. And it's like, you know, improve the things that you can improve. Like, take care of the things that are close to home, because that will improve the global situation. It must. You know, if everybody's house is in order, the whole world's pretty clean. Right? And it's, there's something so, so sacred and so true about, you know, we could talk about like an economic justification for that out. Like, it's totally incentivized. You're totally incentivized to invest locally and, you know, support your neighbors, because it's good for everybody, not just you and them. When, you know, because if everybody's operating that way, it makes the whole system better. And then the other one I'd like to emphasize is the final rule, which for me is, I think, the most powerful, and certainly the one that lingers in my consciousness the most, and it's the one that comes to mind when I pick the pin up, whenever I'm, you know, reorganizing my bag and stuff, whenever I pick it up, it's like, this is the thing that I remember. And it's to seek each day to utter some work or perform some little action which may promote the cause of peace, whether at home or abroad. Just do one thing every day, just one. It can be little. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be leading, you know, leading the revolution, right? It can be a smile. It can be a gesture. It can be a text message. It can be a phone call.
It can be reading.
Something small. It can be reading. It can be taking care of yourself, right? It can be an investment in the right thing. And it doesn't have to be enormous, but it does have to be deliberate. It does have to be conscious, right? You have to make a choice every day to do one thing and summon all of that moral energy into the activity. And by doing that, you instantiate this spirit of peace into a habit, and it becomes part of you. And for me, that's the key, right? I know I'm a, you know, I've got this addictive personality. And so the question is, do I let that control me, or do I control it? And this is the kind of thing that really helps me, because it's like, oh, why don't you just make yourself addicted to being a good person?
Right. So I want to add to that, because we're talking about what are these different things you can do and what are these tools that have been created in this Universal Peace Badge and the Rules of Harmony that you are reading were created by Cora Debrezza in the late 1800s as part of her work for the peace through law movement. And so you can see by law, she's talking about, you know, inner law, inner will, and strengthening that, and so that you can obey the wills that the law, the will that you promulgate for yourself. I also want to say that, you know, I think another thing different that we can do comes from one of Cora Debrezza's closest friends, someone I know that you know, Randy, and that's Mayright Sewell. And she used this phrase, the dignity of continuity, which I love. And she also talked about organization, which we wanted to talk about today, but we're running out of time, so maybe next time we'll talk about the importance of organization to all of this. But the dignity of continuity is about understanding and bringing to consciousness, because it also has to do with this work of consciousness, the people who have come before you and their labors that are part of this thread of effort. And that is a very specific task as well, and that's also different because that causes us to learn about what we call positive history, and that's what this is, you know. And I found that when you look at the the artifacts that have left by the foot soldiers of this movement, such as Cora Deprezza, Bertha von Suttner, Andrew Carnegie, Andrew Dixon White, and so forth, they are very conscious of the fact that there are going to be future generations that continue this work, and they're thinking about them. And they're like leaving things for them. And so this is the work of the dignity of continuity and becoming aware of that. And I think, Randy, you're talking about moral energy before, that there's some kind of transference going on when you're learning about that dignity of continuity or that thread of history. There is not only facts that are being transferred, but as Jane Addams says, moral energy.
Yeah, I could not appreciate that term more. It seems to completely capture the thing that I was trying to drive towards. And
the term dignity
yeah,
of continuity?
So, well, that
moral
and,
energy.
And then the term moral energy was the
okay,
one I was emphasizing.
Okay.
Moral energy is this idea, because it takes the temporal component out. It's like, we don't think of energy as something that goes, that just disappears, right? We have like the laws of thermodynamics burned into us that energy and matter cannot be created or destroyed. And moral energy is a thing, right? And when we study stories from the past and we take the time to learn about how things that we take for granted today were built, this reverential spirit becomes part of us. It builds itself into our lives, and we can feed it. We can, you know, we can transform ourselves by using that as this motive force in everything that we do. And so, yeah, I'd love for next time for us to get a chance to talk a little bit more about this duty to remember, and you know, what things we ought to remember and how we might classify those things and how we might organize the, you know, this maybe this field of things that we do need to bring from the past to the present and, you know, take care of or clean up some of our amnesia.
Indeed. So yeah, like all these, like these specific tools that you're mentioning, the Universal Peace Badge, the Rules of Harmony, you know, were created a long time ago. And so they've been, you know, recreated as part of the work that we do. And yeah, I have found it impactful on myself personally. And, you know, you find the badge useful. And it's, you know, I think the fact that these things are connected to these, you know, stories from history adds to the meaning of them very much. And that's, I think we're all searching for a connection, a meaningful connection to the past. And these stories help us to realize that. We have like a minute left. So, Randy, closing thoughts here on Peace Day? 90 seconds left.
Well, first of all, I deeply appreciate the invitation. I deeply appreciate your introducing me to this subject so many years ago and bringing these stories into my consciousness for the first time. And I guess the thing I'd like to leave on is that, for me, there's absolutely no room for doubt as to whether the process of instantiating the spirit of peace into my life, into my personality, into my being, has worked. Now, it's not completed, of course. Like, I still have more than enough problems that I don't know how to deal with. I'm learning slowly but surely that the higher I aim, the closer I bring my ideals into alignment with my actions, and I strive towards peace, I strive towards the ideal, the better everything at the smaller scale seems to fall into place. And so I really do credit you with at least part of that. And so I'd like to end on a note of sincere gratitude.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd like to credit Bertha von Suttner, Cora de Brazza, Andrew Carnegie, Andrew Dixon White. And this is all part of a common thread of effort. And let's end with Susan B. Anthony. Too much focus on the I and not enough on the you. So you've been listening to The Virtues of Peace. We hope to be back in a week or so. Thank you. Check out our show resources page. It has links to many of the things that we've been talking about. You can go down the rabbit hole that way. And also, to remind you, today is also May 18th, the Gwangju Uprising. Check out the movie A Taxi Driver. So these are concrete things that you can do to start to implement the rules of harmony. Thanks, Randy. And, happy birthday. Tomorrow is Randy's birthday, so happy birthday.
Well, okay. Thank you. Happy Peace Day.
Happy Peace Day. Bye-bye.
Bye.